Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. This month, I'm rebroadcasting many of the most remarkable interviews I've done over the last few years. In today's show, you'll hear the first half of an interview I did with Mike Markovarich, jazz pianist extraordinaire. Blind from birth, Mike began trying to play on his toy piano what he could hear on the radio from the time he was three. He has not stopped trying to learn intricate musical compositions, those of others and his own. Listen to Mike's most inspiring story and hear some of the most delightful music you will ever hear. So hang on, here come the show. Welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about finding, discovering, uncovering, recovering who you really are and then becoming it. If you have listened to any of my shows, you know that I believe that we are all flying under false colors to some extent or another. That is to say that the person that we think we are, the person that we are demonstrating, presenting, telling other people that we are, while that person is us, that is only a portion of the us that really exists. In some cases, we are denying, hiding, misrepresenting large portions of who we really are. In other cases, not so much. But in almost every case, it is my experience, and you know you're just hearing the gospel according to Lynn when you listen to me, not hearing the truth. Of course, you're hearing the truth as I know it. So as I have seen it over and over again in my private practice, I'm a psychotherapist, been in private practice for over 30 years, and as I have seen there and also in my life, we are keeping secrets about who we really are. This is not a conscious or intentional thing. Obviously, all of us keep some secrets. We know that there are things about ourselves that we're embarrassed about or would rather not be so, or, you know, I like to use the example, you know, we laugh at a joke we don't actually get, or say we liked a movie we didn't actually like. There are lies that we tell about ourselves. There are secrets that we keep about ourselves. If you have listened to the show before, you probably heard me talk about how long it took me to accept the fact that I am dyslexic and that that is not a mortal sin, just a trick of the way my brain is wired. And because it's wired that way, there are things which lots of other people, mostly everybody else, can do that I can't do. And I have known this for a long time, not that I was dyslexic, but that there was something wrong or flawed or different about me. I did not know it was dyslexia. I just thought there was something wrong with me. And I spent a lot of time and energy pretending that I could do things I can't do, and not letting on that there were things I couldn't do. I see now that that was a colossal waste of everything, my time, my energy, my feeling about myself, because there's nothing I can do about this, and there is nothing wrong with it. And since I have made peace with it, and everyone I know knows that I'm dyslexic, I'm not expected to do things I can't do, and people help me. Oh, my God, imagine that. So that was a secret that I was keeping intentionally, that I knew about myself, but was not letting you know about. That's not what I'm talking about in the show. What I'm talking about in the show is secrets we don't even know about ourselves. How can that be? Aren't we the people who know us best? Well, it turns out, no, at least not in my experience. In my experience, we learn extremely young that there are ways we are not supposed to be. There are things we are not supposed to be or do or think, ways we're not supposed to behave. And if the emphasis on this is strong enough, the punishment for it, the ridicule for it, the neglect for it, the embarrassment for it is powerful enough, we will figure out a way to submerge that quality, submerge that ability, submerge that way of being. I call it, in my book actually, putting these things under cover. And then the rest of who we are, which is to some extent or another acceptable, or maybe it's just who we were told we had to be, this stuff becomes our cover story. We present our cover story, we show you our cover story, and because our unconscious is so really good at it, we forget that we have a bunch of stuff undercover. And as I said before, depending on the challenges to us, we might have some few things undercover, we might have basic things about ourselves undercover. I have met and treated people who put their intelligence undercover. They thought they weren't smart when they were, or their beauty. If someone was made ashamed enough to think that thinking of themselves as pretty or beautiful, if that was a shaming thing, well, they forgot it and didn't think they were, and certainly didn't let you say anything to them about it. I know any number of people who've put their talent undercover. So, this show is about making that point. There may be, very likely are, things about you for which you are in denial, to use the technical term, that you have placed undercover, to use my term, that you are unaware of. Now, this might not matter. Unless later in life it turns out that some of these qualities are things you really need in order to live the best life that you can live, the life that really was meant for you, that's possible for you. You know, a minute ago I said this might not matter, but I don't really actually mean that. Because even if these qualities are not something that you badly need, It takes energy to suppress. And so some amount of energy that you would have for living the life that you want to live is wasted suppressing. And also, whether we're consciously aware of it or not, to some extent we know that there's something not quite right, something out of sync. And that doesn't feel good. So recovering these things which we have had to hide is a good thing in and of itself. And in my experience, again, quite often it is precisely those qualities that we need later in life that we've placed undercover. You know, it's not uncommon for someone who's had trauma in their life to place undercover their capacity to feel safe. So they spend a whole hell of a lot of their life being vigilant, covering their ass, controlling situations, monitoring, observing, not relaxing, not trusting, not being able to trust in situations where it is safe to trust. Their capacity to feel safe, their capacity to trust is undercover. I don't think I have to make this point about how life would be different for people who feel apprehensive, like they have to control situations, vigilant, how life would be different for them if they could relax, trust, not worry. And that capacity, which comes with the territory of being human, is undercover. We had to put that away because it wasn't actually safe when they were little. So, again and again and again, I talk about this idea that there are qualities, capacities, abilities, identities, ways of being that you may be in denial for. Usually, I talk about this sometimes for half the show. And then in the rest of the show, I play interviews that I did with people who make their living or their life with an art. And I do this because in our culture, in order to give your life to an art, it has to be really who you are. We make it very difficult for artists in this culture. So it has to be absolutely who you are for you to dedicate your life and try to make a living with an art. When you listen to the artists that I interview, you can hear that they are absolutely, definitely who they are. And the first half of an interview that I did with Mike Markovarich is what I am playing today. And Mike is the living, breathing role model, poster child for what it means to be yourself. Having discovered at 3 years old the desire to make music, Mike, blind from birth, has been pursuing this goal, even though the obstacles put in his path would overwhelm most of us. When you listen to Mike, you can hear what it sounds like to be none other than yourself, to be continually coming from what is, to use the technical term, congruent, in harmony with oneself. In addition, I am playing, I think, 3 cuts from Mike's album, Solid, in this show. And the first one that I'm playing is Blame It on My Youth. It's a solo piano piece. And when you listen to it, you can hear what Mike brings to his piano playing. How gloriously lucky we are that he followed his bliss, followed himself, and gave himself to music. So first I'm going to play Blame It on My Youth by Mike Markovarich on piano, and then the interview, and then more Mike music. So you're in for a treat.
So I am here with Mike Markovarich. Did I say that right?
Yeah, you did pretty well. It's
Markovarich.
Markovarich, yes. Markovarich. You got it.
I imagine people struggle with it. Yeah.
You name it, I get it.
I'll bet you.
Every pronunciation you can imagine. And mispronunciation you can imagine. They do their best, but it's they don't always get it.
You're a kind man, Mike.
Well, it pays. It's worth it to be kind.
I believe it. Yeah. I believe it, although you wouldn't know that by some people's behavior.
Well, let's not go. I don't want to. Oh, boy.
So I'm here in Mike's office, which is outside of his studio, which is in his house. And Mike is a master pianist. I've seen Mike turn a room full of uninterested people into people who are screaming and jumping up and down and asking for more and more and more and more. He's not only a brilliant pianist, he's a remarkable entertainer. And so I don't have an agenda for these interviews, Mike. I am doing this radio show and I'm doing this series called Anatomy of an Artist.
Oh.
And I'm just interviewing people who are making their living with their art,
mm-hmm.
people that I have reason to admire when I can talk to them, and I have tremendous admiration for you.
No, thank you.
You are welcome. So it's really just whatever you would want to say about how you found this, some stuff about yourself. You know, this is radio, so people aren't looking at you.
Right. Well, I can remember as about 3 years old, starting to listen to, we had, you might remember these TV consoles that had, it was a large cabinet, and it had a black and white TV in it, and it also had a turntable with an AM/FM radio built in.
I do remember.
You remember those?
I
well,
do.
Now I'm dating myself.
And me.
and my folks had one of those, and I used to love listening to the radio, and they also had 78 RPM records.
Mm-hmm.
And you probably remember those, but not people born in the 80s or in the 70s wouldn't remember those at all.
No, you remember the 33 and...
Oh, of course. I have boxes of them. But back when I was about 3 years old, I used to spend a lot of time listening to the radio or listening to Ken Griffin organ records. Do you remember Ken Griffin?
I do not.
He was one of the first to popularize the Wurlitzer electric organ as an instrument to record on.
Mm.
And his style was, it was very simple, very basic, sometimes three-note chords in the left hand, and he'd work the bass pedals, the foot pedals on the organ. You know, and he plays these simple chords in the left hand and just basically melody and sometimes harmonize the melody a little bit in the right hand. And it was very straightforward, very simple style, but if you can imagine a three-year-old child, my hands weren't very big.
Mm-hmm.
And I had all I could do to try to figure out how to do that.
Are you serious?
I started playing when I was about 3 years old.
On a piano?
On a toy piano.
A toy, well.
I had a piano that was about knee-high. One of those little wooden...
Rinky-tink
pianos that sounds more like a xylophone than
a
piano.
I remember that.
Yeah, and then I had then I graduated to a little pump organ that was about the same size.
Now, you were trying to duplicate this organ?
I was trying to just duplicate what I heard, the melodies and the simple chords.
Yeah, this is literally playing by ear.
Learning by ear.
Learning, right.
I often when people ask me if I play by ear, I say, well, no, actually, I use my fingers. But, which, of course, every time I think about playing by ear, I have this image that comes into my mind of my earlobe getting caught between the keys.
Yeah, right.
You know, not too comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But I learn by ear. I still do
mm-hmm.
now. I learn off of recordings, or if I'm working with musicians that want to play a song often enough, and I work with them often enough, I learn it,
mm-hmm.
you know, just by hearing the chord changes and hearing what the melody's doing.
Now, do you know what you're playing? You know you're playing a C chord, you know you're playing an A minor?
Yes.
Do. So they could also call
They could tell
to
me
you.
About the chord changes, yeah, but then I would have to be able to hear where they're falling, you know.
You mean the voicing?
No, the placement. Because if you say, well, play A minor 7, how long do you want me to play A minor 7?
Yeah, right,
seven?
Right.
That's what I mean by where they're falling, how many measures.
I got it.
Or whether it's a half measure or, you know.
But if they called the chords to you as they were changing or right before they were changing.
Well, I wouldn't even have to. I could hear
you
that.
You could hear that.
Yeah.
That's what I figured.
Yeah,
right.
I could hear that. As long as the chords aren't ridiculously complex.
Right.
Once you start adding all kinds of jazz tensions into the chords, and if they're moving in a strange way, then maybe I won't hear it quite so well.
Right, or quite so quickly.
Or quite so quickly. Mm-hmm. The more complex tunes are harder to learn and take more time to learn.
Right.
In my teaching, I often tell my students, you know, some tunes, when you listen to a tune, it catches you right away, and the melody catches you, you know, attracts your attention. You say, oh, I like this melody, this tune is just so nice.
Right.
So you gravitate toward that, and you learn the melody. So then you've got that much of it learned. Then you tackle the chord changes. Do you learn the chord changes? Then that's done. Then you put it together, and maybe it works. So other times, though, in my experience, and also in the experiences of some of my students, you run across a tune that's just plain hard, period.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing is hard. The melody's abstract and you know, obtuse and angular and weird. You know, compared to some of the more well-known tunes, and the chord changes are also weird. A tune like Lush Life, which goes all over the place, which I love the tune, but it took me about 3 months to learn it.
Wow.
Because it goes so many different keys and moves around a lot.
But once you've learned a really complicated tune, then your repertoire is expanded. Your repertoire of what you can conceive of.
Yes, it helps in that respect. But it also gives you another great tune to play. So, you know, the more of those you have, the better off.
Yes, it does.
But getting back to, we're kind of going in roundabouts here. But so I started out on those toy keyboards.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, I would try to play whatever caught my attention. Try to work on it and learn to play it.
What did your family think of this?
They encouraged it to a point, although both of my parents were working people.
Mm-hmm. Not musicians.
We lived in a mill town up in New Hampshire, Nashua, New Hampshire, which used to be a mill town with a lot of the... My dad, worked in a tannery for 20 years.
Mm.
And he did all kinds of other jobs, too. And both my parents worked until very late in life.
Yeah.
They didn't have the kinds of resources, the kinds of money to go out and buy me a grand piano.
Right.
They couldn't. That was way out of the question.
But they bought you something to play with.
Toy pianos, toy accordions, mm-hmm. toy pump organ. And then when I was about 6 years old and I was getting ready to attend the Perkins School for the Blind, a neighbor of ours had an old upright, which they weren't using, and they gave it to us.
Oh.
So that I was thrilled. It wasn't a great instrument, but all the keys worked.
Mm-hmm.
And curiously enough, now that I think back on it, though, it was one of those old, big, tall uprights that you see in a lot of the, if you have seen pictures or been to a lot of the older clubs in New York, the older, smaller jazz clubs, a lot of them had those big old uprights,
mm-hmm.
like the ones that Art Tatum would play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're as tall as I am when I'm standing up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it all worked, but curiously enough, it couldn't be brought up to pitch because it was so old.
Oh.
So it was a half tone flat, which meant that for me to play in the key of C, so it would sound like the key of C, I had to play in D flat. So I had that challenge to deal with all the time, too.
Yeah.
And so once then, I attended the Perkins School for the Blind in Watertown, Mass., which is a suburb of Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And in the fourth grade, the way things worked at Perkins when I went there, everybody took piano lessons starting in the fourth grade. Everybody took part in the chorus, whether you could sing or not, or whether you could play or not, you took lessons or you took part in the chorus.
Wow.
That's just the way it was. Those things weren't up for negotiation.
Wow. Do you have an idea why?
Well, it was a private school. They could make their own regulations.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. They could do what they wanted.
And I'm very thankful that I got that early exposure to music. In the third grade, I started learning how to read Braille music.
Mm.
Which I don't use anymore. I learn everything by ear, as I said,
right
now, because it's just more immediate. And the Braille music, a lot of the things that the tunes that I would be interested in learning aren't available in Braille music anyway. That's not a viable option. So at Perkins, I had 4 years of piano lessons, and
well, you must have been ahead of the game
in some respects. But when I left Perkins after the eighth grade, I went to Bishop Girton High School in my hometown,
mm-hmm.
which is a college prep Catholic high school that's run by the Brothers of the Sacred Heart.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out how far behind the eight ball I was once I started attending a college prep high school, when my assignments would carry me from the time I get home until 11 o'clock at night with a break for supper.
We're talking about academics.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was way behind.
Yeah, I was. When I said you were ahead, I meant
musically. Yeah. I had a rudimentary knowledge of some things like intervals and chords, although I didn't often know the names of them. I knew what majors and minors sounded like.
Mm-hmm.
But
oh my gosh! So your high school must have been a lot of work.
It was 4 years of hard work, mm-hmm. just to keep up. And my mother went back to school. Practically, you know, she kept her job, but after she got home from work, guess what she did?
Cracked
the books and tried to help me with my homework. And
so did you have Braille?
I had some Braille, and I had some books recorded on reel-to-reel tape.
Oh, my goodness.
So I learned, I that was when I really started getting into working with alternative. Because one thing we haven't mentioned here, although people who know me and have seen me in Sarasota or Cape Cod or wherever I've played know that I am totally blind.
Yeah.
And I'm not at all uncomfortable about talking about that because that's just reality for me.
It
has always been
life.
That way. It
right.
is a fact of life.
Yeah. I didn't say it because I thought it was yours to say.
Well, as you can see, I don't have a problem talking about it. It has posed some interesting challenges for sure. But there, fortunately, even back when I was in high school, people thought of the idea of recording books on tape.
Mm-hmm.
So I got used to the books that weren't available in Braille, and many of them weren't,
mm-hmm.
and couldn't be prepared in time for the next year or whenever they were needed. My vocational rehab counselors up in the state of New Hampshire, you know, put together a list of people to record books on tape for me.
Oh.
So that's how I got through high school, and that's largely how I got through college. Let me get back to high school now. Bishop Girton High School, my junior year, I can remember this as, I don't remember exactly what date this happened, but I got a call to play my first gig.
Oh my God.
My junior year in high school, I got a call from the brother of a classmate of mine who played trumpet in a small combo in town. And he called, and this was a Saturday afternoon, and he called and he said, Mike, I know you play the piano because my brother tells me all about you, and I've heard you play. Our regular piano player got sick tonight. Could you play a gig tonight? I didn't even know what a gig was. I said, well, what's that? What is it? You know, what do you mean? I said, well, we got this party, this bowling banquet that we've been hired to play, and, you know, could you? So he read off a list of a bunch of songs that they usually played, and I said, well, I know all of these well enough to get through them. That won't be the same as your regular piano player, but I'll do the best I can.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my first music gig.
Oh,
that was my first
God.
Paying gig.
So how was it?
It was a ball. And we got fed, too. And I got home. I'll never forget it. I got home with a bill of paper currency in my pocket. It was a cash payment. And it was $10. And that was big money.
I know.
Back in 1967 for a high school kid to go out and play music. I was thrilled.
You know, I want to stop you for a second because I want to say, of course, this is radio, so you can't see, but Mike is as delighted now, I think, almost as he must have been at the time.
Oh, it's
part of his charm, is how immediate his pleasure is, and you hear it when he's playing. You hear this delight that's coming through him, you know, into the keys. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to stop you.
No, I'm glad. No, it's, one thing I tell a lot of my, I tell all my students this at one time or another, and I teach private students here, and I also teach, I'm the adjunct instructor of jazz piano at Manatee Community College, and my college students come here for lessons also, because I'm set up to record and all that, you
mm-hmm.
know. And as you saw when you came in the music room, I have a Mason & Hamlin Grand, and I have a Yamaha Electronic set up, too. So if we need to play on two pianos, we can do it.
Mm-hmm.
It works very well, for the most part. But one thing I tell all my students, at one time or another, or many times if need be, is that playing music has to be fun first. If it's fun first, everything else will take care of itself in due time.
Yes, I believe it. And
it really works.
You know, and you practice what you preach. You live what you say. It's so clear.
Oh, well, thank you.
Oh, Mike, my God. Okay, so so you got that gig. And
so I got that gig, and then, I really got a kick out of that.
I'll bet.
We had a great meal. We had a lot of, you know, fun hanging out on the breaks, and I got through all the tunes alive, no major disasters.
And you thought, this is not a bad thing.
This is pretty good. I could do this sometimes, you know. Then
up until then, had you thought what you might do?
I actually originally, when I was in high school, one of my strong subjects in high school was French.
Oh.
And I was thinking about majoring in French in college and minoring in government with the idea of being a translator or an interpreter for either the U.S. government or the U.N. or the diplomatic service or something.
Right.
But all that changed my freshman year in college. When I was a freshman at Dartmouth College back in 1967-68, a guy that lived in the room next door to me in the dorm I lived in played Oscar Peterson's Night Train album for me one night, and I just flipped out. I said, oh my God, this is what I've been looking for a long time. And I made up my mind at that point I was at least going to explore the possibility of majoring in music.
Oh my.
So I got into jazz piano rather late in the game compared to a lot of people.
Yes, you did.
If you stop and think about it.
And so, now again, your parents are paying for you to go to,
Well, I got they helped. But fortunately, because I had gotten straight A's in high school, through all that hard work, which I alluded to a while ago, I still remember it as clear as day, how long those days were, and but I don't regret doing it for a minute. It's just, but it was, it wasn't the kind of life that a normal high school student lives, nowhere near. I had to work real hard to get those grades. But I knew darn well that I wanted to go to a good college when I got out of high school, not just any college.
Right.
And I ended up going to Dartmouth College.
A good college.
Very good college. And I got a scholarship because my grades in my achievement test scores were so good.
Yeah. What I was going to ask was, when your parents heard that you were...
They were in a little bit in a state of shock.
I'll bet they were. Here they had a translator and a diplomatic corps, and now they've got...
I was going to try to learn how to interpret music.
Yeah, right.
Rather than a spoken language, I was going to try to learn how to interpret the music language.
Yes.
In a way that worked for me.
Yeah, it's very similar, but I'm sure to your parents it's...
But one of their first reactions was, how do you think you're going to make a living doing this? Do you realize how unstable this profession is?
Right.
They had been around long enough to know.
Right.
And, my answer to them was, if I don't at least explore it, I will kick myself for the rest of my life for not having done it.
And they understood that.
They understood that.
Good for them.
And I made an appointment during my freshman year with the chairman of the music department, who has since passed away. But he was an organist, and he taught music theory. And he heard me practicing on one of the Steinway pianos that was readily available in the student lounge. And he was very open and honest about it. He said, I'll tell you what, he said, the music major here at Dartmouth is not really performance-oriented at this point.
Mm-hmm.
It's a liberal arts, music theory, music history kind of major, mostly.
Mm-hmm.
If you can take lessons, but at this point, the way it's set up, we don't give academic credit for the lessons, even though you have to pay for them.
Mm-hmm.
But you can study privately if that's what you want to do, and it will cost you, whatever it was. And then he said, well, I have to tell you something else. He said, we have never had a blind music major here.
Wow.
So that's going to be different for us. It's going to be a challenge. But he was very willing to at least explore the possibility.
Mm-hmm.
So in the fall of 1968, I took my first college-level music course, which was elementary harmony, with the Glee Club director, who also taught theory and whatever, counterpoint and various courses. And he was one of the key people in really helping me absorb the language and learn it a lot faster, because a couple of weeks into the class, after class, he said, Mike, do you have a few minutes? I said, yeah, I have a couple of minutes before I have to go. Well, what do you have in mind? He said, well, how do you think you're grasping the material? Do you think you're understanding the terminology? And I said, well, as doing as well as I can, I'm taking notes. And
it's really hard.
Well, it can be, but... But he said, how would you feel about this? He said, I have in mind one of our best students who's already had this course. He's a very advanced student. He knows his stuff. How would you feel if he tutored you and recorded keyboard examples for you and did whatever along that to help you learn them? I said, wow. This teacher really took an interest in me.
He didn't
have to do it.
I have tears in my eyes.
He didn't have to do it.
That's right.
And I was almost speechless, you know.
I'm sure, because I'm crying.
His name was Paul Zeller, and I said, Paul, I really appreciate this. This is the first time that a professor has taken this much interest, and it means a lot to me, and I will do everything I can to learn this as well as I can, you know.
Yes.
And when I took the exam, I got my first B at Dartmouth College in elementary harmony. So, and that whole year, my sophomore year, I really prayed hard and thought hard about what it was going to mean to try to embark on a music career. Mm-hmm. And as sure as I'm sitting here, one night I was debating what to do, tossing it and turning it around, you know, in my mind. And as sure as I'm sitting here, I heard this voice. Michael, I know you're way behind the eight ball compared to people who have played piano seriously for 10 or 12 years and had studied a lot of theory and all that, but you have the means to do this, and I will see to it that you are able to do it if you just plunge into it.
Oh, Michael.
So I said, okay, there's my answer. That's all I need to know.
Oh.
I'm going to do it. I'm going to give it the best shot I have, and wherever it leads me, at least I will have been able to say I gave it the best shot I could.
Right.
Wow. Well, I don't know whether you got chills, but I got chills. That's probably the closest I'm going to get to a cliffhanger. And I had to split this interview in two because it was so long, and it seemed to me that was the very perfect place to stop the first half of this interview. So I hope that you, like me, were dying to know how it went and what he did and what became of him. And that's what the second half of the interview will say next week. And now, before I close the show, I'm going to play two more songs from Mike's CD, Solid. I'm going to play It Might As Well Be Spring, in which he opens with a drum solo by his drummer, Tony Martin. And also you can hear his bass player, Billy Pillicherry. And then I'm going to play another example of Mike's whimsy. He is so delightful and delighted. So I'm going to play a piano solo version of Take Me Out to the Ball Game. And now, here, Mike and Ensemble, It Might As Well Be Spring. Wow. Wasn't that terrific? I told you. And next week, you can look forward to more and more of that, and actually a very special example of Mike's genius and also his sense of humor when I play Blues for Joe Green, which is an homage to a piece by Giuseppe Verdi, otherwise known as Joe Green. Who would think of that except Mike? So I'm going to close the show now, and then we're going to go out on Take Me Out to the Ball Game. This is particularly appropriate for me because we've got a little AA team here in Sarasota, Florida. And for a number of years when I was really struggling with my life, I bought season tickets. It was quite remarkable, actually. There were 70 home games, and the season cost $70. That was a dollar a ticket, which was really pretty much all I could afford at the time. And I went to ball games 2, 3, 4 times a week whenever they were here. And actually, someday I will tell you more about that. It was an amazing experience for me. But right now, suffice it to say, I have a soft spot in my heart for anything related to baseball. And so we're going to ride out on the show on the wings of Mike playing Take Me Out to the Ball Game. But before I stop, let me once again thank Josh Hackney, who is the person who literally makes this show possible by saving me from whatever technological catastrophes I bring upon myself and whatever technological catastrophes the world brings to me through no fault of my own. And my God, no matter what, no matter how careful I am, almost every week there is something I don't understand or something goes wrong, and Josh rides to the rescue. So if you are like me and you are in love with the technology and want to use the technology in one form or another, but are not young and didn't cut your teeth on it, or, you know, it's just not your thing, or maybe you really are accomplished, but there are new things you want to try, new things you want to add, and you just want a little assistance. And if you do anything with recording, then Josh is the guy you want to have at your back or in front of you or at your side. You just want to know he's there. And so if you do, then you should go up on my website, and I will take this opportunity to say again that the website is thelynshow.com. That's thelynshow. If you leave the E out, you get somebody else. And that you can not only find Josh on my website, but you can tell me that you'd like to get a hold of Mike, either to get his CD or have him come play for you. He plays concerts and parties, and he teaches. So anything related to piano, you want to get Mike, you can get all those people at my website. And anybody else that you heard interviewed on my show, if you haven't written down their email address or their website, you can check out the book, the workbook, the audiobook. You can find the CD from which the first song and the last song that I played on this show come. You can find out about all the other things that I do, anything. And you can listen to the old shows. You just click on new podcasts. It's something of a misnomer. They're all old shows, but you can find them there too. So, as always, I hope that you got something useful from this show, or something entertaining, or something engaging, something that made you glad you listened and made you want to come back next week and listen again, because I will be here then. And boy, I sure hope you will be too.
I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go. That I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten